start Perek Tet, we start chapter 9, we're now moving post-Beis HaMikdash and into a period that unfortunately could be characterized as the down part or the downside of Shlomo's career. It's definitely going to end that way. And so I thought it'd be worthwhile to do a little bit of a recap of what we know about Shlomo at this point, because we've said many things over the course of the year. This is already more than 30 weeks. We've been studying him. We're on our 32nd hour. So there's a lot to talk about. I gave you the outline of chapter 9, but you could see it for yourself on the sheet. I don't have anything to add to the textual outline there. But you know, one overall point that we've seen over and over is that much of what the text applies to Shlomo is ambiguous, could really be interpreted in, you know, different ways, and it's likely intentional. It's hard to read who Shlomo is at this point. In chapter 11, we're going to know. But in chapter 9, I don't know who Shlomo is. On the one hand, you have lots of it, and I gave you a quick list in source number 8. Right? Hashem predicted his birth and said he would be the Yedid of Hashem, the beloved friend to God, and he would build the Beis HaMikdash. He brought all those sacrifices to God in Gibeon, and he was praised for it. He might have had prophecy, depending on whether you take Abarbanel and the Rambam in Commentary to the Mishnah, who say that he has some level of prophecy, or whether you take the Rambam in the Mara Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, who says, no, he's not a prophet. We also had his investment in building the Beis HaMikdash, and he makes it all very nice. With beautiful prayer dedicating the Beis HaMikdash, and he wants it to be... it's all about Hashem for Shlomo. He's also somebody I see what I did on the sheet. More than investing in the grandeur of the Beis HaMikdash, I actually have more to say about that. He built the Beis HaMikdash before his own palace, right? He worked on it energetically. He didn't use David's supplies. Of taking that as a positive, right? Because David's not supposed to build the Beis HaMikdash. He's generous at the dedication with his karbanos, with his sacrifices. He's also somebody of good character. He demonstrated peace when he dealt with Adoniyahu, right? After the coup in chapter 1, he let Adoniyahu live. He carried out David's instructions expeditiously, both in terms of who he was supposed to make sure did not die of old age, and also in his own actions, dismissing Evyatar because he supported Adoniyahu, but he doesn't kill him. He asks God for wisdom, not for wealth. He asks for the ability to judge the people properly. We have that case of the Zonot who come before Shlomo. He judges them with sensitivity. He has this whole elaborate administrative structure and set of financial arrangements that are meant to care for the population to make sure that they're not overtaxed to support his needs. And his focus at the Beis HaMikdash is justice. That was the first thing he asked for in his prayer for the Beis HaMikdash. And then we have wisdom, right? The intelligence in how he deals with Adoniyahu, in which he dismisses him from the court, even though he lets him live, because he recognizes the threat. When Bathsheba wants to hint to him about the threat of Adoniyahu, he catches the hint. He requests, as we said, wisdom from God. He judges the Zonot with wisdom. He has this whole administrative structure, which we're told demonstrates wisdom. His plans that he makes with Hiram are wise, and the people prosper. Shlomo seems to have a good relationship with God, good personal character, and good wisdom. However, there's the flip side, right? We had two major halachic issues. One issue was marrying an Egyptian, which no matter what Abarbanel said, you can't. You just can't explain that away. That's a problem. And he delayed starting the Beis HaMikdash until year 4, which we said may be because he's amassing materials and that's a justification, but we had commentators who looked at that and said, no, there's something wrong here. He was supposed to start building it right away. We see the self-aggrandizement concerns. Right? When he asks to be able to judge everybody himself, we said, you know, Moshe wasn't supposed to do that. Maybe it's wrong for Shlomo to do that. We see him amassing wealth. We see him amassing horses. We see him making the Beis HaMikdash a great grand building, and Hashem in the middle of it gives him a big warning, saying to him, you know, watch yourself, Shlomo. Shlomo's own palace is larger than the Beis HaMikdash, which we gave justifications for, but you look at it as an ambiguous thing that could be a warning sign. He uses his own supplies, not David's. Maybe it's not because David isn't supposed to build it. Maybe it's because I want to be the one to build it myself. I'm making my mark. And finally, his alliances with the other nations, both in terms of marrying the Pharaoh's daughter, which is going to come back in this chapter as an issue, and also in bringing Tsor, Tyre, into the process of building the Beis HaMikdash. Right? That's also, we discussed that at length, that's also not necessarily a good thing. So, things with Shlomo can be read one way, can be read another way. Not so clear. Yes, Susan?
I'm really troubled. Because I like them. I really like them a lot. And it sort of reminds me when Moshe couldn't go into Israel, he did all this stuff. David wanted so badly to build it.
Yep.
We talk about all David's malice. Kind of like Chana said, we still call it David's, but then he's punished. I mean, because it is a punishment.
Were you there when we talked about why David can't build it?
Because of the war, and he fought, and he had blood.
No. We had a whole class where we went through like five different reasons why he couldn't build it. I'm going to ask you to go back to the recordings because I can't recap that right now.
Seems unfair to him.
You got to go back through the recordings. I'm sorry. So Shlomo has a vision now. This is Shlomo's third conversation with God, or message from God is probably a better way to say it. We're in chapter 9. Chapter 3, we had the first one, right? That was an actual dialogue, and Hashem says, ask from me something I'll give you, and he asks for wisdom, and then he gets a whole bunch of other things. Abarbanel said, that's a prophecy. Then in chapter 6, in the middle of the construction, Hashem told Shlomo, I'm going to be with the Beis HaMikdash, right? As long as you do good things. And then you get the third one here. And here, it's the opening sentences of chapter 9. Hashem is responding to the prayer that Shlomo made after he built the Beis HaMikdash. Like the one in chapter 3, it is said to appear in a chalom, which you could read as a dream, but remember that the word chalom can mean a prophecy. This week's Torah portion at the end, when Hashem tells Miriam and Aharon about prophecy and the difference between Moshe and them, Hashem says, "Bachalom adaber bo," I speak in a chalom, but it's still a prophecy. So so here, Shlomo is going to get a great message from God. The last message from God is going to come in chapter 11. When Shlomo has already started to sin, and that one is a negative, is very clearly a negative message. So what's the message here? What is it that God is saying to Shlomo here? So take a look at chapter 9. Rambam will believe that this is not a prophecy, but rather God sent it as a message to a prophet, like Achia HaShiloni, who we know is active at that point in history, and Achia HaShiloni brings it to Shlomo. That's the way the Rambam reads it. So take a look. Sentence 1 just says, when Shlomo finished building the Beis HaMikdash, as well as his palace and all the things that he wanted to do. Sentence 2, Hashem appeared to Shlomo a second time, as he did in Gibeon. This is excluding the message that came during the construction. This is more like the original message about what he, you know, asking God for something. Vayomer Hashem Elav, and Hashem said to Shlomo, Shamati es tfilascha ves tchinascha asher ischananta lefanai. I heard your prayer. I've heard what you asked for. Hikdashti es habayis hazeh asher banisa lasum shmi shamar olam. I have consecrated this house. As you asked, my name will be there forever. Vahayu einai v'libi sham kol hayamim. My eyes, my heart will be there for all time. Ve'ata, and you, if you will walk before me as your father David did, with a pure heart, righteously, to do according to all that I commanded you, chukai mishpatai tishmor, you guard my laws, then Yisrael olam, I will support your throne forever. Just like I told David, your throne will continue, the family will continue to be on the throne. We've talked about before that Hashem has a long temper with the kings of the house of David because of the merit of David in establishing that line. And then he says, there's the flip side, sentence six. Imshov teshuvun atemu v'neichem me'acharai, if you leave me, you or your descendants, v'lo sishmu mitzvosai chukosai asher nasati lefneichem, if you don't follow my laws, and you worship these gods of others, right? Sounds like Shema, with good reason. Then I'm kicking Israel off of the land. And I'll get rid of this house that I have consecrated in my name. And the Jews will be a model for everybody else. They're going to say, look what happens. I'm not going to go into the grammar of that sentence. The commentators discuss the yihyeh, whether it means the house that was highest will now be something that people look at and they whistle like, wow, or whether it means this house will be the highest, it'll be the thing that everybody looks at as a demonstration of what happens. But they're going to say, which is a direct lift from the book of Devarim. Why did God do this to this land? Why did God do this to this house? And they're going to say, it's because they left God who took them out of Egypt. They held on to the gods of others. They served them. And that's why God did this to them. Professor Keel, in the Dot Mikra edition, does something interesting here. He notes the relationship between the first prophecy in chapter 3, and then the prophecy here. He says, on the one hand, this prophecy closes a positive circle from that chapter, right? In chapter 3, God promised, I'm going to give you wisdom and wealth and honor, and now at the end, God says, look, I fulfilled it. I gave you wisdom, wealth, and honor. Yeah, mission accomplished. But now it's with a very different tone that Hashem is approaching Shlomo. Take a look at source number 9, please. My translation. The first nighttime vision Solomon merited at the start of his reign in Gibeon was entirely organized in a manner of affection and satisfaction. God granted Solomon much more than he asked. But in the second nighttime vision which he merited, which resembled the first in its prophetic level, right? It's on a high level. He's like a barbanel. God only responded to Solomon regarding that which he had requested. You asked me to dedicate the house? I dedicated the house. And the essence of the vision was a severe warning for Solomon and for Israel. Things are not as bright as they once were. Clear? Okay. Yes, Janine.
You said, I think that the Rambam does not believe that Shlomo was a Nevi. What does he do? I don't remember that.
Yep. So you're correct.
This is Vayera Hashem El Shlomo. How does he...
Yeah, so the Rambam, right, so Janine asks, if the Rambam doesn't believe that Shlomo is a Navi, what does he do with the words, God appeared to Shlomo? And the answer is that the Rambam believes that it means God appeared to the prophet with a message for Shlomo.
Does that ever happen about anyone else?
Yes.
By Eira, El somebody, and I'm not discussing whether it's in a dream or not. But
yeah, no, but I believe it does happen with others as well. Well, there it says it's a dream, though. The Rambam believes that that's a dream, Avram and the three angels. Yeah. But, you do have this idea in general. The Rambam actually, when he says it about Shlomo in that chapter in the Morah, he's actually using Shlomo as an illustration of the concept, and he mentions that it exists there for others as well. Yeah, if you go back in the recordings to where I did it, and it's a while ago, it was back in chapter 3. So that's where we discussed it. I don't remember offhand chapter and verse, so to speak, except that it was in, I think, never mind, let me not guess. Okay. So having now seen this message to Shlomo, we now get to a very strange passage. This one took me a while to grasp. Sentences 10 to 14, something weird is going on here. Take a look. I'm going to read out an English translation quickly just along the way. I'll just translate it. It was after 20 years when Shlomo built his two houses, the house of God and his own palace, right? We've talked about that quite a bit. Hiram, king of Tsor, had elevated or given gifts to Shlomo. Nisa can be read as elevated, but also like Mases, gifts. He had given to Shlomo cedar wood and cypress wood and gold. And then look what happens. Then Shlomo gave to Hiram 20 cities in the Galil. Really? You just land for what? Land for wood. Not land for peace. Land for wood. And it gets better. Hiram came from Tzor to see these cities Shlomo gave him, and he didn't like them. And he said, what are these cities that you've given me, my brother? And he called them the land of Kavul until this very day. I gave you a quick list of explanations for Kavul. Kavul is understood to mean like when you chain something up. That's Kavul. So the Gemara in Shabbos offers three explanations that I bring here. One, it won't bear fruit. It has to do with the practice they had with sheep, of preventing the sheep from mating. They connect it to that. Second, they were manacled in gold and silver, meaning that they wouldn't work. They were so wealthy that they weren't interested in working, and that annoyed Hiram. Or they were trapped by the ground, meaning the ground was so poor that there were cracks in the earth, and like people walking along would get trapped in the ground, and Rashi here brings that approach. And then the last explanation Radak offers is that it's a place where nobody went. Nobody wanted to go there because the land was so terrible. So he gives him a gift. Hiram says, what kind of gift did you just give me, my brother? And they called it the land of Kabul, until this very day. And then one more sentence, sentence 14. And Hiram sent to the king 120 talents of gold. I'm assuming kikar means talent, because it often does. I don't know what that means, but it's a something of gold. Yes, Janine.
How was he allowed to give away?
Yeah, what in the world? Where did this come from? Who, what? What are you doing? And it's bizarre. It's bizarre on so many levels. Flip back, please, in Malachim to chapter 5, sentence 25. Because my gut, when I read it, is to say this is payment. Right? You gave me wood, you gave me cypress, I'm paying you for it. But we had a deal for that. It was chapter 5, sentence 25. We're told, Hiram gave to Shlomo cedar wood and cypress wood, that was in sentence 24, and Shlomo gave to Hiram 20,000 kor of wheat, and 20 kor of oil. Like, we know, that was what he gave annually every year. It's explicit. We know what the arrangement was. So what's going on? Why is Shlomo now giving him all of these cities? It's very hard to understand. And then, hang in there. And then, take a look at source number 12. Janine asks, that's Gemara in Avodah Zarah, based on a pasuk. The Torah says, Lo sichanein. Regarding the nations you encounter when you enter the land, Lo sichanein. The word sichanein is a very strange word. I'm not going to go through the grammar of it right now. But the Gemara has three different explanations for what lo sichanein might mean, and one of them is lo sitein lahem chanaya bekarka. Do not give them a camp in the land. Shlomo, you have no business giving that. The Rambam brings you in Sefer HaMitzvos in source number 13. Why is it that we are supposed to stay away from doing that? The answer is because otherwise we will learn from their behavior. If they accept the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noach, the seven Noachide laws, no killing, no stealing, and all of that, then fine, they can live in your land. But otherwise, they're not allowed to be there. You could make the argument that maybe that's just the seven nations. Especially given that Shlomo is about to marry a whole bunch of women who he's not supposed to marry, and also in that same passage, you're told not to marry them. Maybe it's just the seven nations. Nonetheless, the commentators assume universally that this is a no-no. Almost universally. That this is a no-no. So, I don't understand what Shlomo just did. He's paying something he didn't have to pay, that it seems he's not allowed to pay, number one. Number two, what's wrong with these cities? Why does Hiram not like these cities? And number three, if Hiram didn't like these cities, then why did he call him, he called him brother, and he gave him 120 kikar of gold. Like, make up your mind, pal. And not only that, all of this is strange enough, right? I feel like, what's the sales pitch? I don't remember what I'm thinking of, but take a look at Divrei Hayyamim and Bet, chapter eight, sentences 1 and 2. Oh, but wait, there's more. That's what I was thinking of. But wait, there's more. The bottom of page 1955, if you're using the Stone Tanakh.
Tell me again.
It's on your sheet.
Is it possible that Hiram was not in a
So there's a lot to be said about Chirim. When we introduced Tzor a while back, I showed you the arc of Chirim in Chazal, in our sages, based on verses here and in Yechezkel, and how he starts out good, and then he becomes arrogant and goes bad. But take a look at what you see in source 14. You see the reference there. Chronicles 2, Divrei HaMbet, chapter 8. Because this is just going to flip everything, literally. Look at this. At the end of 20 years, after Shlomo had built the house of God and his own house, the cities that Churam is Churam, we've talked about that, gave to Shlomo. Shlomo built them up and he settled the Jews there. So now I'm completely lost. Now Churam is giving Shlomo cities. It will be a lot easier if we could just say, yeah, Divrei HaYamim has problems. But we don't usually take that approach. So what was it that's happening here in this story? Rose, I see your hand, but I'm going to go through the story and give some answers, and then I'll come back to comments and questions. I want to make sure everybody first hears the questions, hears answers, and then we can discuss. So, I'm going to show you two different approaches, Radak and Abarbanel. Radak says this was a swap. It was meant to cement the relationship between them. You give me cities, I give you cities. It's like when I drive into Thornhill, right? The little thing on the side there, partner city of twin city of Ramla. That's what this is. If you take a look at source number 15, he says, I'm reading my English translation for time purposes. In these buildings, Chiram elevated and supported Shlomo with cedar wood, cypress wood, and gold. In return, King Solomon aided him, giving him 20 cities in the Galil. Radak is totally fine with that idea that he gave him cities. And in Divrei HaYamim, it said that Chiram gave Shlomo 20 cities in his land, and he settled Jews there. And they did this to strengthen the pact between them. And it mentioned in this book, meaning Melachim, that which Solomon gave to Chiram, and it mentioned in Divrei HaYamim that which Chiram gave to Solomon. This is an extremely unsatisfying answer. I mean, Ralbag is bothered by how can you give up land, and his answer is, it's a land swap. So Israel is not reduced, and therefore it's okay. That's his answer. I think the reason why Radak has to say this, and not what Abarbanel is about to say, is because Radak believes, we said this back in chapter 5, that the payment Shlomo gave Chiram was only while the work was being done, and then it was done. Abarbanel was of the belief that what Shlomo was promising Chiram was annual support, not stopping there. And so that leads to a different approach. Take a look at source number 16 and what Abarbanel says was going on here. I'm going to read out my English translation. Oh, no, I'm not, because apparently I didn't translate it on the sheet. Huh. Okay, so I'm going to translate it on the fly. He says, I think that Shlomo gave Chiram annually what was listed above, the wheat and the oil, you know, the amounts that he needed for his house. And after the work was done, he decided to give Chiram cities in the Galil, not that those cities should now be under Chiram's control and Chiram should be their owner and they would be bound to Chiram as though he's their king. Shlomo would then be violating the mitzvos of the Torah, which, you know, again, we'd rather assume Shlomo didn't do, even though we know that there are times when that's what the text says. So then what was this? It was a gift that those cities should be used to collect annually the wheat and the oil that he was giving him. In other words, he's saying to Chiram, I have to give you wheat and oil every year. It's going to come from those cities. That's who's producing it. And perhaps the idea was that Chiram's men would actually come and they would harvest there, right, and would work the land, which would then produce all that Shlomo had promised to give him. I'm flipping onto the other side now. Chiram went to go see these cities and to see, could these cities really produce the wheat and the oil that Shlomo promised him? And he didn't like the cities. It appeared to him they weren't going to give enough produce. And therefore he called it Eretz Kavul, meaning a land that does not produce fruit, like we saw from the Gemara. And therefore, he said, I'm not satisfied with the gift that you gave me. That's what's going on in Malachim. So what happened? In Divrei HaYamim, it informs us that because Hiram didn't like those cities, Hiram gave Shlomo those cities back. What's describing in Divrei Hayamim is him saying to Shlomo, thanks but no thanks. And then Shlomo built them up in order to show, these aren't bad cities. Look, these are good cities, and he put Jews there instead of Hiram's men to have them work the land, and that way they would produce what he was supposed to give to Hiram, and every year he would give Hiram the wheat and the oil, and it's all one story. The advantage that Abarbanel has over Radak, aside from saving Shlomo from violating yet another law, is that it also makes it one story. Meaning, within Radak, I don't understand, why did you mention one gift in Malachim and one gift in Divrei Hayamim? Right? Like, if it's really a land swap, then mention both in both places. So Abarbanel is trying to rescue us from that by saying, no, we recorded the gift, that's here, and in Divrei Hayamim we mentioned, and he gave them back. Still not 100%, so why didn't you mention in Malachim that Hiram gave them back? Like we said, he called it kavul, meaning he's obviously displeased. But I feel like then, like, it should be parallel. I would have been happier if the two passages were actually parallel.
But he never gave land.
That's the question.
No, and hang on, sir.
He never gave land. He only gave the
farm. He only gave him the fruit from the cities. Yeah, he's only giving him the fruit from the cities. I wanted to finish that point with two things. Number one, you could read this as a warning sign on Shlomo's alliances, especially if he's giving away cities. Meaning, we talked about in my recap of Shlomo, we have concerns about his alliances. This is a red flag, and the way the text chooses to describe it is a deliberate red flag. Meaning, it could be what he gave him was produce, but it doesn't. The text is trying to say we have a problem. On the other hand, you could read it as another sign of Shlomo's wisdom, right? Which is how Abarbanel wants to read it, is that it's Shlomo's wisdom. You could read it the other way. Okay, there were questions online. One second. Rose, you had your hand up, and then Ricky, and then Dahlia.
So I just want to confirm, this area is the Galil,
yes,
right?
Up north.
Okay.
Yeah, which makes sense, because Tyre is up north. Yeah, Ricky, and then Dahlia.
I'm glad you held off my question.
Good.
Because that whole interpretation of Abarbanel is almost satisfying.
Okay.
My question.
Almost satisfying is all we ever hope for.
Almost
satisfying is all we ever hope for. Dahlia, what do you have?
Okay. I don't understand how we can take people off of their own land. Every one of the tribes has a land to work.
Good.
Okay. So who are these citizens of, or whatever you would call them, Ezrahim or whatever, of Israel that he just puts there?
Right.
And that sounds like the communists. I wanna move you around, put you in a territory.
So you have a communist here, you better be careful.
Like they're serfs.
So
it sounds horrible.
It's a good thing you're on Zoom and she's in person. And you all heard the question. So the answer is, one of the commentators, if I remember correctly on this, I think it might have been Rashi, commented that this is entirely within Shlomo's rights. Oh, you know what? It's not on this. It's on the next section, but it'll apply here as well. Go back to the Mishpatei Hamalucha, the rights of a king, as Shmuel described them to the nation. He can take your land. He can take your children. He can do whatever he wants. This is Shlomo exercising royal prerogative to say, yesterday you were a citizen living over here, and now you're a citizen living over there. And yesterday you worked here, and tomorrow you're working there. This is what a king is able to do. Like, that's, you're 100% right for pointing it out, but it's consistent with royal authority. Kings are barrel of laughs. Okay, I'm going to stop here. It is 2:30. Thank you so much. We have two more weeks, so please make sure to be back. We have a lot coming up. I don't know how we're going to do this in 2 weeks, but we're going to do the best we can. Thank you very much.
We have-